The Hard Shoulder on Newstalk.
With Nissan Subscribe and Drive. No deposit, no compromise, no fuss. Find out more at nissan.ie.
We are just 70 days today until the Brexit transition ends. So for more on this, I'm joined by Simon Coveney, Minister for Foreign Affairs. Minister, what hope is there for a deal in those 70 days?
Well, look, I mean, I've described it as doable but difficult. And I think that really sums it up. We have a lot of work to do. We have very little time to get it done. We have two negotiating teams, one representing the EU, the other the UK, that have now agreed to a scheduling of very intensive negotiations to work on the basis of legal text. So we are very much in the end game now, trying to close this out. But there are still, you know, significant obstacles in the way of being able to agree a trade deal and a future relationship agreement.
What are they today then? What are the significant obstacles?
So there are two really. One is that the EU will insist, and they're right to insist, on there being fair competition between the two economies, that's the UK and the EU, because the proximity to each other is so close that we can't have a situation that at some point in the future, a British government decides to deregulate its economy or to, in a targeted way, provide grant aid to certain industries through state aid that goes way beyond what the EU is allowed to do, and therefore derives competitive advantage for British companies over EU companies, and to have a trading relationship that doesn't involve any barriers or tariffs or quotas. So that has been something that the EU has insisted on for over a year now. And the UK at the start of the year agreed to that approach and has since moved away from it. So unless there is a level playing field and a series of agreements and guarantees around that, as well as a governance model that can deal with disputes, if and when those disputes arise, in terms of unfair competition, there won't be a trade deal. I think both sides understand that, and I think they're making some progress in relation to trying to resolve the differences there. So the other issue, which is highly emotive and very, very political, is fishing. And the problem with fishing is that the expectations on both sides are so different, that the two sides are very, very far apart. The British government has made very significant promises to their fishing industry and fishing communities around what Brexit means. And the EU has prioritised fishing in the EU negotiating mandate to protect what we have today on fishing. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get an agreement on fishing. But one thing I would like to say to fishing communities in Ireland is that we have discussed this at length within the EU and within the negotiating teams. And the EU will not be selling out fishing interests in an effort to get a deal in other areas.
Do you worry at all, and sorry to cut across you, do you worry at all that the stumbling block could be politics and not policy, and that, say, the British, that they've painted themselves into a corner, that they won't be able to relent on fishing, such as the level of promise they've made? And, you know, when you talk about a level playing field as well, even that phrase has kind of turned toxic in the UK.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, if we get an agreement on fair competition, it won't be called the level playing field, because that term, as you say, has become toxic in Westminster, a bit like the backstop did previously. So it'll be described differently in order to get a political agreement here. But I do think the British government understands that if there's not commitments and guarantees around fair competition between the two economies, there's not going to be a trade deal. Fishing is different because it's more raw politics, if you like. And the promises that have been made are going to be very, very difficult to deliver on. But don't forget that there is a reason why the EU insisted and the UK accepted that fishing had to be negotiated and agreed and concluded in the context of an overall trade deal. Because the UK needs facilitation from the EU in many different areas, like aviation, for example, like road haulage, like data security, like energy. You know, the UK wants to access the EU energy markets. And the EU is saying, and I think they're quite right, they're saying, well, look, you want to access our energy markets, we'd like to access your fishing grounds. So it needs to be part of an overall package deal. And I think that is the way this is going to be done.
And that
whereas if we separate out something as emotive and as political as fishing, and try and solve it on its own, then I think that would be very, very difficult for both sides.
And that overall package deal, what is the realistic deadline? We've obviously talked about it a lot here in the show over the last couple of weeks, and there seems to be a bit of consensus among commentators and commentators nonetheless, but that the first week in November really is when you'd want to have the nuts and bolts of this in place.
Yeah, I mean, I think the middle of November is probably the outside of this. I mean, after that, I think we really do run out of time in terms of the ratification process. Because don't forget, once the deal is done between the negotiating teams, it's then got to go to a European Council meeting. It's got to go to the European Parliament. It's got to be agreed and ratified in national parliaments in some countries. There are a number of weeks that are required in terms of ratification. So I think that, you know, once we hit the second week of November, we're really moving into a danger zone in terms of running out of time. So that's why you've seen Michel Barnier using the kind of language that he uses today, that, you know, we must use every day now and not waste any time to try and find a way of getting agreement. Okay. Because don't forget, the absence of agreement in the next few weeks means that on the 1st of January, the EU and the UK and Britain and Ireland will be trading on the basis of what's called WTO, World Trade Organization terms. That means the imposition of significant tariffs on many products and possibly the imposition of quotas as well on certain products. And just to give you an example of what we mean by that. So Ireland sells about 5.5 billion euros worth of food and drink to the UK every year. We import about 4.5 billion euros every year. And so on the exports alone, for that agri-food product, particularly beef and dairy product, we've calculated that somewhere between 1.35 billion and 1.5 billion euros in that range of tariffs would apply to that trade, which is enormous and is going to impact on our price competitiveness in the British market when it comes to beef and dairy products in particular. So that kind of disruption really would have a very, very negative impact on the Irish economy. And on, you know, farm family income and so on. So the stakes are very high here. They're very high for Britain. They're very high for Ireland, and they're high for a number of other EU countries as well. And we do need to find a way of getting a deal. If we don't, I think it'll be a monumental failure of politics, quite frankly. Okay. We're working hard to make sure that doesn't happen. But look, nothing would surprise me here with Brexit. This could fall apart. And that's why my message to businesses today is you need to take this as seriously as the government is taking it. You need to prepare for a worst case scenario. And even in a best case scenario, the trading environment is going to change very significantly from the 1st of January on, and you need to be ready for that.
Yeah, I know that's a good message for business. And I know you have a huge amount of sympathy for businesses, say, that at the moment find themselves shuttered. And I just want to ask you briefly about that. And I just see comments from Professor Mary Horgan from your part of the world, so I'm sure you know her, talking about leveling off in some of the figures that she's seen in recent days, which, of course, would have nothing to do with level five. We wouldn't see an effect of that yet because of the lag. And then when I look as well from the Department of Health in Northern Ireland about their restrictions in, say, in Strabane and Derry, where they had a real serious spiralling out of control of their outbreak, and their R number really coming down as well on the back of the restrictions they have there. And those restrictions include gyms being open, churches being open, retail being open, golf and tennis clubs being open. And I just wonder if over the next 5 to 7 days, if we were to see numbers coming down, hospitalizations coming down, well, you mightn't see the hospitalizations yet because of the lag, but overall numbers and that R number coming down, would the government consider going back to level three, certainly for parts of the country, in advance of the level five lockdown expiring as planned?
Well, look, I think the government has been convinced by the numbers that we've been shown by NPHET and our public health team, that we needed to take quite dramatic action
You obviously were convinced because you made the decision, but I just mean if over the next 5 to 7 days you see those numbers come down, there'll be nothing to do with level five. And I just wonder if you see them coming down, you'll be able to look and say, hold on, level three was possibly achieving what we hoped it would in some parts of the country. I'm not necessarily saying nationwide, but if, say, in Cork or in Kilkenny or Carlow or Kildare or Leash or somewhere, they say, hold on, the numbers are well down and it's because of level three, we shouldn't be keeping businesses shuttered in those parts of the country.
But I mean, the problem with that approach, though, is that once you start releasing restrictions, you know, you potentially then fire up the virus again to
But if you go back to level three, if you go back to level three and level three was bringing it down, you would assume that going back to level three would continue that downward trajectory.
Well, if you look at our national figures, level three wasn't doing the job that it needed to do. That's why we've said that we need to.
It wasn't doing the job it needed to do in some counties where it was in for long enough, but in most of the country it wasn't in long enough. And what I'm saying is Professor Mary Horgan and we today had is saying that, hold on, we're seeing some of the effects of level three in other parts of the country, and it looks like it's leveling off numbers and bringing.
I hear what you're saying. I hear what you're saying. And we've had that discussion and we don't agree with that approach. What we've said is that we need a period of significant restrictions in order to get this virus nationally down to a level where it is contained and controlled. And so what we've committed to is a 6-week period. We've also committed to a 4-week review. Where, of course, the government can make decisions if it's the right thing to do from a public health perspective. But I think what we need to focus on now.
I'm just surprised because if next week the R number is 0.5 in Cork, that means that under level three, the R number was 0.5 because level five won't have kicked in yet. And you'd be saying to businesses, well, we're staying in level five, lads. You know, businesses in your constituency that have shut up shop.
But Kieran, I have an obligation to be honest with people. And next week, the R number is not going to be 0.5 in Cork, unless something absolutely remarkable happens that nobody is expecting or has predicted. So, you know, this is tough stuff for many people. We're asking many businesses to make significant sacrifices, which I know is causing a lot of stress and a lot of worry and huge disruption to people's businesses with an awful lot of cost. So, you know, I need to be honest with people when I'm asking people to make those kind of sacrifices as a member of government. Then I have to give them the truth as I see it, unvarnished. We need to make a significant impact on slowing this virus down. 204,000 people across the European Union have died from COVID-19 in the last 9 months or so. And the virus is accelerating in most EU countries, including in Ireland. Level three restrictions did have some impact. It has slowed down the spread of the virus in some counties, but it's not enough. And if we're going to have a December and a Christmas that's meaningful, as the Taoiseach has said, well, then we need to make a big impact to get the R number down below one and also to ensure that we're down to, you know, figures of less than 100 per day in terms of positive tests. We can do that in the next 4 to 6 weeks. When we have that done, then the contact tracing and the ability to be able to stamp out clusters when they emerge becomes much, much more manageable and effective. And that's where we need to be. So, you know, I'd love to be saying that we're going to be able to change decisions in a week's time or 10 days time, you know, if the figures are encouraging. But we have to take the measured advice that we've got from COVID. There'll be lots of experts out there that'll give us different advice and they're all worth listening to. But, you know, we've made a decision here. I think we need to follow through on it now, take the benefits from that and hopefully have a much more optimistic December as a result of it.
Before I let you go, another decision I just want to briefly ask you about, the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Inquiry. I actually want to read you just a very short little piece that Fionn Davenport, a former colleague of mine here, I'm proud to say a friend of mine as well, wrote for the Journal today. Fionn was born in a mother and baby home in St. Patrick's in the Navan Road, one of the biggest in the state. And he says, in rushing through this bill, the government was clearly not interested in finding a solution that would respect the rights of victims to have their stories told in the open while protecting the anonymity of those who wish to remain so. It is profoundly troubling. How can you repair the damage of the past if it remains shrouded in secrecy? And more worrying still, how can you possibly guarantee it will never happen again? In the meantime, the victims of the mother and baby homes are condemned to 30 more years of darkness. For many, the time will run out altogether. For Jane, my birth mother, perhaps even for me. What do you say to Fionn?
Well, first of all, I say to him that what the government is trying to do here is the opposite of what he's interpreting. But I can understand why he's written the way he has, because many, many people have contacted me with very similar sentiment. What Roger Gorman, as a minister, is trying to do here is to ensure that vital information and databases are not lost or aren't sealed away for the next 30 years, and that we put a system in place that allows us to be able to manage information in an appropriate way that's consistent with the legislation that set up the Commission of Inquiry, but that also allows victims to be able to access their own information. That's what he's trying to do. I was listening to him this morning on Morning Ireland when he effectively apologised for the mistakes that he's made in terms of the communication around this, in terms of explaining to victims far more clearly in terms of what was needed around communications. He's going to try and address that now. But look, this is a really, really sensitive issue.
Yeah.
I know that. I know a number of people who have been deeply impacted by their own personal stories and connections with mother and baby homes, as many people who are listening will have. Mm. The government really needs to reflect on how we can reassure those people now. And I can tell you there are a lot of discussions happening today amongst ministers in terms of how we do that better.